AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, getting the show started a little bit early today as we're going to be joining the Minnesota Department of Health public briefing today as we have some unfortunate news on what's happening with COVID-19. And we're moving in the wrong direction in Minnesota as we have 922 new cases being reported today, as well as four deaths, including one child who was under the age of 5 years old. So we are getting that unfortunate news, we are going to join in with that Minnesota Department of Health news conference. Let's see, do we have that up quite yet? Nope, they're still working on trying to get that feed. So once that is up and running, we will go ahead and join that as the head of the Minnesota Department of Health is going to be on that call, as well as I believe a few others who will hopefully have more details, as this is the first instance where a child in Minnesota has died of COVID-19. The only information we have on this right now is that the child is from Clay County, which is in outstate Minnesota. Other than that, we don't really know much else, but that is certainly very concerning. It's a trend that has happened in other states where they've seen children come down with very serious health problems or even die from COVID. New York and California had outbreaks in those regards a couple of months ago. Minnesota has been fortunate in that we haven't had those types of cases up until today. So hopefully we'll be learning more about that in just a few minutes. But looking at the overall numbers, like I said, 922 new cases. That is a record number in the state. We have never reached that high, 922, so that's not a good mark whatsoever. The percentage of tests which came back positive also shot up above 5%, which is above the recommendations from the World Health Organization of how when you can allow businesses to stay open. According to their recommendations, they say that you need a rolling 7-day average of 5% or less. And today, our positive percentage shot up to 6.3%, although our rolling 7-day average still checks in at 4%, according to Johns Hopkins University. So there's the latest on what's happening with COVID-19 here in Minnesota. Check in, still nothing yet on the Minnesota Department of Health. Hopefully we'll be able to join them. As a heads up here, Patrick, let's try that other alternate feed I sent you. Sometimes they're a little bit late getting that over to us, so we'll see if they have anything on that alternate feed for that MDH conference. Also in some other COVID news today, 14 bars and restaurants have been warned for breaches of COVID-19 measures. Yeah, 14 of them overall, including, I believe, I think it was 9 or 10 in the Twin Cities. I'll try to get you that full list of bars and restaurants that were unfortunately warned by the Minnesota Department of Health for violating certain safety measures that the governor instituted with his emergency coronavirus measures. That follows a 2-week sweep that saw 919 establishments surveilled by investigators to see if bars were maintaining social distancing, if employees were wearing face masks, and if bars were adhering to that 50% maximum capacity rule. The Department of, actually, you know what, let's hold off on that, as it sounds like we do have that conference, that news conference with the Minnesota Department of Health beginning right now. Let's turn it over to them.
I'll now turn it over to Commissioner Malcolm.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon, everyone. Across the world this morning, we were above 14.5 million cases and 606,000 deaths. In the United States, as of this morning, we were over 3.7 million cases and 140,000 deaths. We announced today an additional 922 cases from yesterday, bringing our total to 47,107. I'm going to comment a little further about that number in just a few moments. There are some artifacts in the number with affected by data conversion that we did that Chris and I will explain momentarily. But clearly that's an alarmingly high daily total, and we have known and been commenting for several days now about the increase in day-to-day cases that we're seeing. The median age of our cases is now an even 37 years old. There are currently 247 patients in the hospital, 115 of those in intensive care. So as our case numbers have increased, we are now starting to see over the last week or so a trend upward in hospitalizations, although, again, we are still significantly below our highest levels of hospitalizations, which we saw in late May. The tests yesterday were on the testing volume yesterday was 14,287, and the seven-day average testing positivity rate is 4.7%, an increase from 4.4% a week prior. And as you recall, that testing positivity rate has a seven-day lag factor in it, just due to what we're seeing with turnaround times varying quite a bit among the national labs and some of our Minnesota labs. So just bear in mind that that 4.7% positivity rate calculation is actually of according to the data from July the 14th. Week over week, though, we've seen a 12.9% increase in total testing volume and an 8.6% increase in new cases. So we are seeing, as we test more, we're seeing more cases, but as some states have noted, that they're seeing a larger percentage increases in cases than even in testing, indicating that they're still not testing enough. What this tells us is that there's the more we test, the more we will find, but we're staying ahead of that ratio. We had a total of four additional deaths yesterday in Minnesota, bringing our total to 1,545. All of these deaths yesterday were residents of private residents, none from long-term care facilities yesterday. These were one each in Clay, Olmsted, Ramsey, and Scott counties for the deaths. This total includes one person in their 90s, two in their 60s, and very sadly, one less than a year old. We're very sad to report the death today of a nine-month-old who tested positive for COVID-19. Based on what we know at this point, the death appears to be an isolated incident related to this infant's very specific situation. Obviously, out of respect for the family's privacy, we're not going to be sharing more about this case, but our sympathies very much go out to the family, and any COVID-related death is a loss, of course, and a death involving such a young person is tragic and certainly very unusual. As we understand it, this is one of the youngest deaths reported in the country to date. In order to better understand the situation, we've asked CDC to do some additional analysis as well, and Chris may wish to comment further on this if you have questions. COVID can clearly spread through multiple people in households, and this just underscores the importance of developing a plan for an emergency that might prevent parents or adults in the household from caring for their children. Chris mentioned last week the Make a Plan Minnesota campaign, and we would encourage families to learn more about this by going to mn.gov/COVID-19, and you can find the Make a Plan information there. And I'd like to go back to the issue with the very high number of cases yesterday. So those were all the cases that came in from the labs yesterday. Over the weekend, our infectious disease team migrated to a new data management system, which is a really good thing because this new system is better able to deal with the high volume and is more stable for the long-term response that we know we are going to be working on for some time. The conversion went smoothly, and I'd like to really thank all the staff that worked extra hours and hard to make that happen as smoothly as possible. But you noticed that we had a delay in posting the updated numbers this morning, and we know that all of these cases, these 922, have not all been vetted through our typical process. So staff were working on the data conversion, and so you'll see that when it comes to completion of investigations, our numbers for missing and unknown data sources of transmission is higher than normal. And the data themselves, as I mentioned, reflects some cases in the queue that were not fully vetted before today's release of the numbers. So I think what that means, and Chris can explain this better than I can, is that there'll be some kind of abnormalities in the data over the next few days as a result of this data conversion. They will ultimately be all sorted out, but we may see some unusual numbers over the next couple of days just because of this data conversion. This is a really good thing that we've made this move, but it is going to cause us a little bit of inconvenience in the numbers over these next couple of days. However, it is certainly the case that the cases are going up. They've been going up. We know there are more cases in the pipeline, so to speak. So in that sense, today's number is sobering, certainly, but not a surprise. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chris and see if you can add a little more clarification to the number situation, Chris, and the data conversion.
Thank you, Commissioner. As the commissioner said, over the weekend, our MDH infectious disease operations team migrated us to a new data management system. And the reason that we did this is that this system will be better able to deal with the high volume of cases that we're seeing each day, and it's more stable for the long-term response that we know that we're facing. Additionally, we chose to make this migration because the system that we're now using combines both the laboratory and the case data into a single system, which for the epidemiologists and the team that is doing the case and contact investigations, that is really helpful. It's also the system that we've used with our other disease reporting, and so it will allow us to streamline our work for workflows and case assignments. And the Minnesota Minute IT team is also a really strong partner with us in using this system, and so they'll be able to help us as we continue forward using this new system. Additionally, this is a system that both internal and external partners routinely use, and so will be beneficial in that way. And in the process of building out features and upgrades to this new data system, it will benefit all of our infectious disease work. So this system is used by other infectious diseases for surveillance. And so although it benefits us now for COVID, it also benefits our infrastructure for our ongoing infectious disease response. So those are the reasons that we were looking to make a change to the system that we had been using. As the commissioner said, in the process of making this change, we're finding ourselves in some choppy waters as it relates to our data. So, as she said, we reported 922 cases for today, but some of those cases, in fact, 665 of those, were still in the queue. We found ourselves in a position of having 257 cases that had gone through the entire formal process, and knew that was not accurate in terms of the total number of cases that we were seeing, but also know that by reporting numbers that are in the queue, that there will be corrections that occur over the next number of days. The reason that this may sound confusing is that we are continuously getting in results from laboratories. So it's not like laboratories all report by noon and then we don't get any more reports in till the next day at noon. It's constantly rolling, and so we have to sort of cut the numbers at a certain point in time. And what happened this weekend with the conversion is that the process was slower. We had staff who normally would be working on processing new laboratory results who had to work on assisting with the migration. We also had a new process for staff to learn, so that slowed things down. As a result, we had a bottleneck in terms of vetting results. And so we know that the number of results that ultimately went through as vetted were insufficient to reflect the true number of cases that were seen yesterday. On the other hand, we want you to know that the number of cases that we reported today include cases that were in the queue and had not gone through that vetting process. So over the next days, our data will be a little bit choppy as we continue to go through vet cases, add staff to help pull us into this new system. So it's a situation in which we were all celebrating on the weekend, because sometimes when you do data migrations, you can have systems crash, you can have all manner of strange things happen. And we did not have that, and our team did a really great job. But it did slow down the process of vetting, and so we're in this position of having data that is going to be modulating over the next couple of days. So I want to be clear on that. I want to explain kind of where we found ourselves and in the challenging place of how do we reflect where we're really at a time when things in this migration mean that things are constantly moving. So I hope that was helpful. I'm sure you'll have plenty of questions. But with that, I will turn it back to Mike Schomer, and we will be happy to take your questions.
Thanks, Chris. As we open it up for questions, we'll ask that reporters limit themselves to one primary and one follow-up so we can get to as many as possible. With that, operator, we are ready to take questions.
All right. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then one. And it looks like our first question is going to come from the line of Jeremy Olson with Star Tribune. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Chris, Janet said that you might be able to provide some information on the CDC doing some additional analysis of the...
Again, you're listening to coverage of the Minnesota Department of Health press briefing. Let's turn it back over there.
Why have you asked for that? I know you can provide more details on the death itself, but maybe on what you're trying to learn from it?
Oh, certainly. Well, as the commissioner said, I mean, an infant death is devastating, and thankfully there have not been a lot of infant deaths in the country. But we want to make sure that we're understanding as much as we can about this infant's the physiologic changes that occurred with this infant in terms of the progression of their illness, as well as we want to make sure that any information that's available on the course of this infant's illness is added to the broader understanding of infant deaths across the country. And so the specimens that were collected to be evaluated here are being sent to CDC so they can do additional evaluation. And that's not to suggest that the evaluation done here was insufficient. That is absolutely not the intent, but rather that these data and this information, CDC can look at it and can provide us with more information, and then it can become part of the greater scientific knowledge about deaths in infants related to COVID. Does that
help? And as a follow-up,
yep.
It does, but you've talked about this being a unique situation, but in other deaths you've characterized whether there were underlying health conditions. Would that be accurate in this case if this child had some sort of disorder or an underlying health condition that was relevant?
Oh, you know what? I can say that the child did not have an underlying health condition.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Tim Nelson with NPR News. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a little curious about the Department of Public Safety's availability earlier today. They're talking about doing nearly 1,000 visits to bars and restaurants around enforcement. And we're also talking about the possible mask mandate here. You know, if they're going to that many bars and restaurants and writing these citations, are you at a point where you're starting to weigh recommending another shutdown?
Well, I think this is Jan. We've reported also that we've been doing additional enforcement through our environmental health staff at both the state health department and local health department. So I think the focus, has been and is on making sure that everybody knows what the current executive order rules are and knows the importance of complying with them and the penalties that can come with not complying with them. We definitely have had and will keep our eye on what we know about any clusters associated with bar and restaurant cases and whether those are increasing or decreasing as a matter of this stepped up enforcement action. But we're also, you know, talking with others around the country to see what effect any changes in bar and restaurant operations have had on transmission rates. So it's, as I think I said last week, it is always a topic of ongoing conversation. We've not made any specific recommendations yet, but that will be a conversation ongoing.
As a quick follow-up, I'm watching Beltrami County. It looks like they've almost doubled in cases. It's not a big number, but a significant jump in the last week. Any idea what's going on up there?
Chris, can you answer that one?
Sure. Yes, there were a number of events, athletic events and different things like that, that people had been engaged in that we know were linked to transmission. So we're aware of what's happening in that area, and we're aware of some of the activities that have gone on. So does that help? It's a combination of multiple things, but gatherings, events, athletic activities, that type of thing.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Emily Havoc with CARE 11. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's anything else you can tell us about the infant death. I understand the privacy concerns, but can you tell us what the infant symptoms were, how the case was identified, if you know where it was contracted?
This is Chris Ayersman. Well, a couple things. In general, with young children, most exposures tend to be household because that's the focus of their activity. And the child had, you know, symptoms of COVID. So, in other words, some of the expected, you know, respiratory symptoms, that type of thing. And did show evidence of some inflammation in the upper airways. So, you know, I guess to say symptoms consistent with what you might expect from COVID.
And then do you know how long a child was in the hospital?
The child was not hospitalized.
Okay. Yeah, I guess with no underlying conditions, anything else you can tell us about why you think it was a fatal case?
I think that's part of the reason that we're trying to, or that we're hoping that by providing some of the specimens to CDC, that collectively as we look at infant deaths across the country, that will help inform this. I mean, obviously this is very rare. This is the first and only death that we've had in anyone under 20, and if you look nationally, the number of deaths in very young infants is very small. And so there's just a lot that we don't know. And so our goal is to help to contribute to that understanding so that it will help us going forward.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Catherine Rickert with Minnesota Public Radio. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi. So I've noticed that there is an uptick among people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. We kind of understand the uptick in people in their 20s right now, and it looks like people in their 60s and 70s have plateaued out. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on why we're seeing an uptick in that sort of middle-aged group right now. What's behind that?
I'll turn that one over to Chris as well. Thanks, Chris.
Okay. Yeah, I think that what we're starting to see is more activity in all of our populations. So because of increase engagement with other people. So I think if we look at how cases have changed over time, certainly we talked about initially in the outbreak we were seeing a number of cases in older individuals because our focus in testing was in that most vulnerable group of individuals who were in congregate care settings. We also started to see a shift then as we started to see more workplace outbreaks. And so we saw a gradual shift downward in some of our case ages because we were looking at individuals in the workplace. And so we saw a gradual shift there. And those early cases were because they were in critical infrastructure, because we were focusing on testing there. Now we're at a place where we've had more opening up within the state, and we're seeing many more people of all ages engaged in more social activities and more interaction. And so initially we were seeing a lot of cases in the 20-somethings simply because we saw a lot of cases that were tied to particular bar and restaurant outbreaks. And now as we see cases in individuals who are a little bit older, what we're seeing is the impact of broader gatherings, whether it's, you know, get-togethers, family get-togethers, you know, people that are enjoying the summer and not social distancing like they could. So we're seeing this evolution of who is getting COVID because of how the evolution of our activities. And so that's how I would describe this older group. It's not focused. It's not particularly necessarily the bar scene like we saw with the 20-somethings, but it's part of that gradual increase in social activities.
And if we were to do a mask mandate, which I know is being discussed, how would a mask mandate affect those sorts of gatherings you just described? Because I don't think you can force people to wear masks if they're having a barbecue in their backyard, right? And if that's a real issue, does a mask mandate do much to change that?
Well, this is Jan. I'll comment first and then certainly welcome Chris's insights as well. Yeah, you're right about the specific nature of a gathering and whether people would be inclined to wear masks at a barbecue or not. However, I think the mandate just would serve to just reinforce the expectation that it is the norm to wear a mask in most circumstances in which you're out in public and interacting with other people, particularly in close proximity. And so we do believe, and I think the data has shown that in areas, states, countries with mask mandates, it does materially increase the usage rate of masks, and we see it translate into reductions in cases as well. Chris, anything to add?
No, I'll just reiterate what you said, that there's increasing data that suggests that masks have a real utility in helping to prevent transmission of COVID. And so there's definitely many benefits to having people wearing masks in indoor settings. And as you said, people, you know, we don't have sufficient staff to enforce every situation, but I think it sends an important message about the value of masks.
You're on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, as you've been listening in on the Minnesota Department of Health press briefing on what's been happening today with COVID. We unfortunately have had a record-setting day for new COVID cases, 922 overall that have been reported. We had four deaths, including one child under the age of 5 years old. In fact, during that press briefing, I believe they said the child's age was just 9 months old. No underlying health conditions, and the child was not hospitalized either. The kid was from Clay County, which is basically kind of the Fargo-Moorhead area. Other than that, they weren't really able to tell us a whole lot more, but certainly that is Yeah, very sobering news to hear, yeah, that COVID has taken the life of a nine-month-old child. So certainly shows that this disease can affect people of all ages. We're going to take a break and come on back with the news of the day, as we have lots to report to you from the state legislature, including what looks to be an agreement on police reform. We'll talk about the bonding bill and some other state and local news here on FYI Politics.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is all digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
During this stay-at-home time, many of us are getting around to what needs doing at home. So how is your vacuum cleaner running? Is it time to get it repaired or maybe even replaced? Great news! A1 Vacuum in Roseville is open for curbside service. We're here from 10 until 2, Monday through Saturday. Give us a call at 651-222-6316 to place your order for curbside supplies, repairs, or replacements. Find more information and updates at a-1vacuum.com.
Let's talk about getting your home zero res clean. To say your home has been lived in these last few months is probably an understatement. Have you assessed the damage? Dirty carpet, food stains, pet accidents, dust buildup? Now is the perfect time to give your home a deep clean. This month, take $50 off your air duct cleaning when you mention AM950. Zero Res will use their negative air hypervac 12-step cleaning process to extract all of that crud out of your air ducts the right way. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMinnesota.com.
How's your back? This is Gregory Rich from Habitation Furnishing and Design and host of Drink in the Style. If you've been working from home, you may be noticing the shortcomings of that one-size-fits-all desk chair that you bought at Office Warehouse. So I'd like to invite you to check out the most durable, most supportive, and most productivity-inspiring line of office chairs that I know of, the X-Chair. Dozens of settings ensure a perfect fit, so you can focus on your work and not your butt. Seriously, the seat moves forward and backward, the entire back moves higher or lower, the self-adjusting lumbar support provides the perfect level of resistance. And you can only experience the X-Chair in person at Habitation. So if you're ready to upgrade your home work environment, come check out the X-Chair. Habitation Furnishing and Design, 7777 Washington Avenue South in Edina, and online at habitationdesign.com. Again, habitationdesign.com.
With all the convenient big box stores that sell appliances, why do so many Minnesotans choose Warner Stellion? Check online to learn that Warner Stellion is a Minnesota family-owned business for over 60 years. Warner Stellion sells more brands than anyone else, and our passionate specialists are committed to impressing you so much that you'll refer us to everyone you know. That's our mission here at Warner Stellion. Ask around. Check us out online. And when it's your time to buy appliances, join over 300,000 Minnesota homeowners and choose the specialists, Warner Stellion.
During July, Standard Heating and Air Conditioning is offering $700 off new energy-efficient air conditioners with payments as low as $50 a month or 0% financing. No doubt that's a great offer, but is it a hot deal or cool savings? Either way, you'll be escaping the latest summer heat wave in cool comfort. Find out more about these great savings on a new air conditioner at standardheating.com. Standard Heating and Air Conditioning, the comfort you deserve since 1930.
Hi, I'm Frank Brown, owner of the only minority-owned union print shop in Minnesota.
Do you work with political campaigns?
Yes, we have years of experience helping campaigns.
Do you print buttons for political campaigns?
Yes, we print everything.
Do you print rally signs?
Yes, we print everything.
Do you print T-shirts?
Yes, we print everything. Choose the only minority-owned union print shop in Minnesota for all your political campaign needs. Learn more at mpuptown.com. Minuteman Press Uptown. We print everything.
AM 950 weather. I'm Patrick Loya. Partly sunny and 82 this afternoon. Overnight tonight, 66 and mostly cloudy. Join Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces for their annual store-wide sale where you'll find the guaranteed lowest prices of the year. Now through the end of July, come in and experience the diverse selection of fireplace products. 2901 East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. We're calling 612-338-6606 or woodlandstoves.com.
And we're on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So we have some breaking news from the state legislature as Senate Republican leader Paul Gazelka said the Senate has struck a tentative agreement with Democrats who control the House on a series of police accountability proposals, setting a deadline of midnight tonight. So about, what, a little over 9 hours away from that self-imposed deadline to pass any deals and then adjourn the special session of the legislature. Now, here's what's in this agreement that Gazelka says they have between the House and the Senate on police reforms. It includes a ban on the use of chokeholds and warrior-style training for police officers, a favorite style, by the way, of Minneapolis Police Union head Bob Kroll. The bill also includes changes in police arbitration, which is interesting because that could be appealing to Republicans in a couple senses. We've talked about this before, how right now the arbitration process for a police officer is that if they get fired, they can appeal their firing to an arbitration person. And statistics show that 50% of the time, the officer gets their job back. Now, most public employees, police officers and non-police officers, are subject to this arbitration ruling. But with this law, they are making changes to police arbitration. We don't have any specifics on that, but the reason I say that could be appealing to Republicans is that if changes to that arbitration process affect not only police officers but other public employees, that is something that could be appealing to Republicans and something that DFLers might not be thrilled with. Also in the bill is the creation of a new advisory council within a state officer licensing and standards board. That was all according to Paul Gazelka thus far. At least some of the media people I follow have been texting with DFL House members to get their thoughts on the bill. State Rep. Carlos Mariani, one of the more powerful members of the DFL House caucus, texted his reaction to a media member to the tentative police reform deal. He said he was reading the language now, but when asked if he believes the police reform bill will pass the House today, he said, "Yes, I do." So looks like we might get something. And then in addition, DFL House Majority Leader Ryan Winkler said he hopes to return to the chamber about a half an hour from now, around 3 o'clock, with the language of the policing bill compromise to eventually take a vote. So we might finally be seeing some action on that. Again, the big highlights are the ban on chokeholds, the ban on warrior-style training, changes in police arbitration, and the creation of a new advisory council within a state officer licensing and standards board. A lot of technical jargon on that last part, but not included in that bill, though, which is something that Democrats were pushing for. Was the idea is when you have a police officer kill someone, they wanted a neutral prosecutor in that case rather than a local county prosecutor, since oftentimes in those situations you run into a county attorney or a local attorney as a prosecutor who might have a conflict of interest, being that they generally work with the police on many other cases and therefore might be hesitant to prosecute a police officer. One of the ideas being floated is that you would bring in the attorney general as the prosecutor when you have a trial involving a police officer who has killed someone. But that is not included in the bill, and I'll say this one more time, not to sound like a broken record, but any major action we're going to see on police reform is going to come at the local level, not so much at the state level, although a few of these measures are definitely a step in the right direction. Also out of the state legislature today, by an 82-40 vote, the House has adopted a resolution declaring that racism is a public health crisis and forming a select committee to analyze potential legislation. I'm sure the intent is in the right place, but it's oftentimes very easy when you have political leaders saying, we're going to put together a committee on something. Or the other thing, I love this type of language. I don't know if you've picked up on this language, Patrick, but anytime you get a politician or really anyone who says, we need to rethink this issue, we need to reimagine this issue, that's just code word for complete BS, and they have no idea what they're going to do, or they have no intention of taking any action whatsoever. Yeah, I always love that. I always love that language when people say we need to have a conversation or we need to reimagine this issue. Yeah, I don't want to be too negative on this idea that they declared racism a public health crisis, but I always get a little skeptical when I see we're going to have a select committee to analyze potential legislation. That sounds like it could be something that could get caught up for years and years being studied and studied and studied and studied and studied and then studied some more. Now let's move along to the state Senate. What else has been happening over there? Well, they have passed a resolution asking that Governor Tim Walz not place public schools under additional executive orders as they are set to put forth a bill allocating $25 million of CARES Act funding towards helping schools reopen. So what they're saying is that they don't think the governor should be doing this at a statewide level, and that is part of their resolution. By the way, the governor, at least according to many sources, have been saying that he is expected to make an announcement on how schools are going to operate by the end of July. I've even heard a few people talking about that. An announcement could come as early as this week. So, yeah, some schools are looking at potentially having kind of a hybrid system. I think I was talking to a teacher in St. Paul that were saying they're looking at kind of a hybrid system where they would have students in class for 2 days a week with the other half of the class learning remotely for those 2 days. Then they would flip around for Wednesday and Thursday. And then Friday, I think, was going to be kind of another hodgepodge of things. So different districts are trying to figure out how to operate, but they might be getting some guidance from the state on what to do with a school learning. Also, this is coming out of J. Patrick Coulihan of the Minnesota Reformer. Good source to follow if you like following along with local politics. He says Governor Tim Walz is expected to announce a mask mandate as soon as this week. And I would, as we heard on that phone call earlier, generally you're not going to have like the mask police going to everyone's private home and saying, oh, you're having a barbecue and you're not wearing a mask, here's a fine, and so on and so on. Generally, that's not the case when you have statewide mask mandates as seen in other states around the country. Generally, that just means is that it's trying to create a sense of normalcy in terms of wearing a mask, where if you wear a mask, it comes across as being normal. They're trying to, well, normalize the idea of mask wearing. So that announcement is expected later in the week. And by the way, if only we didn't have this become a political issue, maybe we could actually crush the curve rather than flatten the curve, even though the curve has started to trend up. Yeah, instead we decided to go in the direction of places like Florida, Texas, and Arizona, instead of, well, maybe taking the model of New Zealand, for instance, which has no new cases of COVID-19 whatsoever. A couple more pieces of news from the state legislature. So the bonding bill does not look like it's going to happen during this legislative session, even though the majority in the House and the majority in the Senate have come to an agreement. That doesn't matter, though, because to pass a bonding bill, you need 60% of both chambers to vote in favor, and the DFL in the House does not have a 60% majority, and the Republicans in the Senate, they also don't have a 60% majority. And the holdup is that the minority members in the House, the Republicans, are saying they don't want to pass the bonding bill whatsoever. But even if we did get this bonding bill passed, there is an interesting little nugget that was thrown in the bonding bill that could make it unconstitutional. This is written over in MinnPost by Peter Callahan. I almost forgot his name for a second there. But Peter Callahan was talking about how the agreement that at least Gazelka and the House Speaker Melissa Hortman came to was a $1.35 billion public construction projects bill. But also inserted in this bill was a $99 million tax cut in that exact same bill. And the problem right there, and I think we've had Mark and Fridley call on this in the past, is that according to the state constitution, is that if you look at it, Article 4, Section 17, got it right here in front of me, no law shall embrace more than one subject which shall be expressed in its title. So in other words, each bill that is passed by the legislature is only supposed to have one subject. And the argument that some House Republicans and even Democrats are making is that with this proposed bonding bill, if you include a $99 million tax cut, it becomes a two-subject bill, which makes it unconstitutional. By the way, we've had bills that have multiple subjects passed in the past. Just unfortunately, no courts have really had the gall to rule that any of the bills passed are unconstitutional, including the Minnesota State Supreme Court. The most egregious example would be the 2018 so-called Omnibus Prime Bill, which had all sorts of subjects within that Omnibus Prime Bill. But technically, if you do read the language of that constitutional statute here in Minnesota, again, it says, no law shall embrace more than one subject, and we violated that many, many times over the years, but as I said, no court has actually enforced that statute of the Constitution. So that's another interesting thing that was thrown in there with that $99 million tax cut. By the way, the reason that was thrown in there was to have an agreement between the Senate and the House. The tax cut was being pushed by Senate Republicans, which mostly has to do with giving tax refunds to certain farmers, is what I'm reading into it. It's something that Democrats said they weren't in favor of, Republicans were in favor of, but they used that as a compromise to say, all right, well, we'll include your tax cut in this bill if you vote for the rest of the bonding bill. So it was more of a compromise type of thing, but technically does violate the state constitution, at least as I read it through. Let's talk to Gary in Minneapolis before we head to break. Gary, what are you thinking about today?
Hey, Brett. You know, they've been talking a lot about what's going on with this police violence stuff, but another issue that really hurt minority races and stuff, but, you know, Martin Luther King followed Gandhi's approach, nonviolence, but Gandhi also said poverty is the worst form of violence there is, and in my neighborhood and around the South Minneapolis, there's tents all over it all, so I used to call that Trumpville. They used to call them Hoovervilles, so maybe not just Trump, but the whole darn Republican Party, so just wanted to say a few things like that. Also, Hubert Humphrey once said something very pertinent. Treat someone like a dog, expect to get bitten. There's much truth in that.
That's actually a very apt quote there, Gary, and appreciate the phone call, as always. Hey, I forgot to bring this up before we head to break. I think this thing is worth talking about, too. So this weekend, State Senator Warren Limmer, who is a Republican from Maple Grove, got a visit from several protesters at his personal residence. In fact, there was a video of this. I didn't have time to watch the entire video since it's like an hour and a half long, but it was posted by the Minnesota Senate Republican Caucus Facebook page. Here's what they said about the video. A group of angry protesters showed up at the home of Senator Warren Limmer today in Maple Grove. They felt the need to trespass on his property, yell and chase neighborhood moms, Jesus Christ, and use vulgar anti-police chants in front of kids. Now, from the few minutes I watched, I skipped around a little bit. I didn't hear any of that at all. Chasing neighborhood moms around. Yeah, you can tell that they're desperate to try to win back those suburban voters. Mostly they were just chanting Black Lives Matter slogans, among others, not saying or not chanting any vulgar chants, as they're saying, according to this Facebook video. But here's something important to point out with this here. At least when it comes to protesting at the personal residence of a member of the state legislature, I'm a little more hesitant in that category just because I'm not exactly comfortable with the idea of going to the personal residence and having a protest. Feel free if you disagree to call me at 952-946-6205. I think that's a little bit different than, let's say, protesting at the governor's residence, being that he has a higher office. But as I was reading through the comments, the now somewhat prominent Republican state senator Scott Jensen commented on this Republican Facebook post in regards to Warren Limmer having his personal residence protested. He said, quote, a little uncomfortable of showing up at the – well, let's see. Here's the quote. He commented and said, where has civil discourse gone? Yeah, that was his quote. Where has civil discourse gone? Which, as I said, I'm a little uncomfortable with the idea of protesting at a personal residence, but for Scott Jensen to comment and say, where has civil discourse gone? Keep in mind, this is the guy who's appeared on Laura Ingraham's Fox News show many times in the past. I think he's been on Hannity's show several times. And, of course, the leader of his party is Donald Trump. So I don't think he's exactly the best person to be saying that we need more civil discourse when he's going on right-wing TV, and especially someone like Laura Ingraham's TV show at that. All right, we're going to take a break. Come on back with a few more miscellaneous stories. You're on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Hazel's Northeast is back and offering some of the most creatively prepared comfort food you'll find. Delicious breakfast options include the slow-cooked brisket hash, chicken fried steak, and the famed drunken banana French toast. Or for lunch and dinner, there's Swedish meatballs, wild rice gumbo, and more. Hazel's Northeast is open Wednesdays through Saturdays, 8 to 8, and Sundays, 9 to 2. Hazel's Northeast delivers real good food. Family-owned at 29th and Johnson in Minneapolis. Make your reservation now at hazelsne2go.com.
Hi, this is Laura. These are indeed confusing times. So much of our life, education, business, meetings have moved online, yet not everyone has internet access. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is here for everyone. Radio reaches people without internet. In fact, radio reaches more Americans than any other platform. 92% of U.S. adults listen to radio every week. Radio connects. If you know some organization, maybe a religious or civic group, seeking to engage and knows that a Zoom call costs money and does not reach everyone, consider a taped or live broadcast on AM 950. Perhaps a virtual not-so-silent auction, recovery support, spiritual support, business networking, poetry slam. If you want to learn more about creating a live or taped message on AM 950, call 952-946-8885 or email Laura at am950radio.com. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here for everyone.
Hi, this is Ken Hagland, host of Living Healthy and Aging Well, inviting you to listen to our new show airing on Saturdays from noon to 1, where we talk about your health and your life and provide insights to living and aging well. Each week, we provide answers to important questions regarding health care, elder care, end-of-life care, and caregiver support to help you and your loved ones plan for the future and enjoy your highest quality of life today. Please join us every Saturday from noon to 1 for Living Healthy and Aging Well.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. I'm a better neighbor because my service has taught me how important it is to be a team player. My training helps me in my classes when I give attention to detail to the task at hand. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my country safe from threats. Learn more about how you too can live and serve part-time by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
Think your company's safe? Your staff is working from home, right? As I speak, cyber criminals are mounting attacks across the country. Remember, when we're weakest, cyber criminals attack. Hi, Mark Sommerfeld from Rimark. The Rimark team is guiding our clients through these difficult times. In fact, demand has been so high, we created an easy-to-follow guide. It's yours free. Download our 5 steps to securely work from home now at RimarkIT.com or call 651-328-8900 for a no-cost how-to discussion.
If you're looking to save money on your home or building improvement project, check out Better Futures Minnesota's reuse retail warehouse in South Minneapolis. We carry salvaged building materials such as cabinetry, flooring, plumbing fixtures, appliances, lighting, and more, saving you money and saving the planet by keeping these items out of the landfill, by giving them another life. Selections change daily, and we also take donations. Go to betterfuturesminnesota.com and look under Reuse Warehouse to learn more. Let us know AM 950 sent you.
We're back on the final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Big show coming up tomorrow. At 2:30 on tomorrow's show, Representative Ilhan Omar is going to be joining me ahead, of course, of her primary race in the 5th Congressional District. So make sure you tune in for that. Tomorrow, 2:30, we'll be having Ilhan Omar on the show. Get to some more news before we wrap things up today. Speaking of one of Ilhan Omar's colleagues, that would be the Republican representative in the 1st District, Jim Hagedorn. Apparently, he spent a whole lot of his allocated annual budget, according to Legistorm, which tracks political and legislative spending among U.S. House members. According to Legistorm, Hagedorn has spent $570,000, or roughly 40% of his office's annual $1.4 million budget, just in the first 3 months of 2020, which, if he continues his spending spree, he will have spent 159.1% of his budget. Now, why has he spent so much of his office budget so far? Well, a lot of his expenses are itemized, such as printing, which is roughly $215,000, and so-called franked mail, which is $58,000. He's been sending what's called franked mail to his constituents. Now, if you're not familiar with this term, City Pages is reporting on this, by the way, franked mail is a way of getting free postage for campaign mailings under the guise of constituent communication. So, really, the money is supposed to be used just for sending out general mailings to your constituents talking about what you're doing in Congress. It's not supposed to be for political advertising, which looks like it might be the case because that franked mailing makes up about 20% of the budget he's spent so far. The next highest representative of both Democrats and Republicans only spent 0.8% of their budgets on mass mailing. So, as Legistorm is reporting, and City Pages also wrote an article on this, yeah, something kind of weird is going on in Hagedorn's office. By the way, the second place spender in the House was New York Democratic Representative Hakeem Jeffries. He spent roughly 30% of his budget during the first quarter. And that's significant because Hakeem Jeffries, keep that name in mind, he's rumored to possibly be the next Speaker of the House when Nancy Pelosi eventually retires from Congress. So that another name to keep track of. Also in some local news today, so Jacob Fry has appointed a new city attorney. And the name of the guy he's appointed is Jim Rowatter, who is a former Target executive who's been with the company since 1994. What's significant about him is that back in 2011, he appeared in an anti-union training video for Target employees. Hitting up some national stories before we wrap things up, this is just breaking from the Chicago Tribune. Gregory Pratt over in the Chicago Tribune is saying that Trump's Homeland Security Department is making plans to deploy 150 federal agents in Chicago this week, with the scope of their duty unknown. So more of these unknown police officers that were in Portland over the weekend look like they're heading to Chicago this week. By the way, Republican Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky is actually concerned about this. He says, "We cannot give up liberty for security. Local law enforcement can and should be handling these situations in our cities, but there is no place for federal troops or unidentified federal agents rounding people up at will." I guess a broken clock can be right twice a day in the case of Rand Paul, if only he were against other aspects of Trump kind of using the heavy hands of the law. And by the way, speaking of crime and safety, Trump likes to portray himself as being the crime and safety or the law and order candidate. Well, according to a new Washington Post ABC poll, Biden actually leads Trump in that category, 50-41%. So just kind of funny to throw out there. I don't think it really means a whole lot in terms of the election. But yeah, even the law and order message of the Trump campaign not working. All right, that's all the time I got for today. Stay tuned. We got Matt McNeil coming up next here on AM 950.